recessed till 9 this morning. I believe that we were on House Bill 120 when we recessed. Senate Bill 120.
Well, might as well be House Bill now, right?
Yeah. And fix it. Hopefully, we'll be able to get to move the bill. We did have... Were you guys just about done?
Mr. Chairman.
I think they've said enough.
Chairman Jardell, we finished our testimony.
Yes.
Yeah, they always spoke their terms.
We have...
The special assistance on this eloquence.
What happened to the union members, you know? Anybody know? They're not here.
Mr. Chairman, do you know if in previous hearings on this particular piece of legislation, if the unions were supportive or opposed, or...
I have no idea.
Is there anybody that could talk to that?
They're not here.
Sure, I did it yesterday.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Susan Cox, Assistant Attorney General. I testified yesterday. We've had hearings on this bill and its identical House bill counterpart, HB 164, in both Senate and House committees, obviously. In the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, an attorney for the MEBA, the...
There you go. He can speak to it right there.
Okay. Well, he hasn't testified before, but Mr. Geldof testified for the MEBA. I made some comments suggesting that there be further legal review. Senate Labor and Commerce Chair Con Bundy asked us to actually do the review that is in your packet. I think they did not take a position for or against the legislation. The Inland Boatmen Union of the Pacific, IBU, has had a representative testify at House Labor and Commerce, and a different gentleman testified at House Judiciary. At House Labor and Commerce, the testimony was, questioning some of the ideas as a policy matter and whether it was legal or not. I didn't take their comments to be strongly for or against one way or the other. Frankly, I think it was fairly neutral, more observations and comments. But at House Judiciary, Representative Guerra asked the speaker for the IBU there if they were for or against the bill, and that gentleman couldn't take a position. They were invited to submit a position, and at the next hearing on the bill, they weren't there, and as far as I know, I haven't submitted anything right, at least nothing I've ever seen. That gentleman, I think his name was David Morris, testified at House Judiciary. He thought this bill would actually benefit, I think he said 98 or 99% of the members, more than the current system.
Very good.
I hope I fairly characterized what they said.
You kept your comments a little shorter today. I appreciate that.
Okay, for the record, I forgot we have Representative Moses Chenault, South Williams, Co-Chair Harris, Vice Chair Meyer, Representative Stokes, and Croft are present. We do have Peter Lipinski on from IBU on teleconference from Ketchikan. Peter, do you have your testimony to give this morning?
Yes, I do. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am the patrolman for the Inland Boatmen Union in Ketchikan, and it is the official position of the IBU Alaska region that we oppose this bill. We do not want to go into workman's compensation. We feel it will be very detrimental to our members. Besides the legality of the issue of taking sailors out of the maintenance and cure provisions under the Jones Act, we just do not feel it would be in our best interest.
Any questions for Peter this time? Is that your testimony?
Yes, short and sweet.
Okay. I don't see any questions here, Pete. Thank you. Anyone else that wishes to testify here in Juneau on this? Anyone else on teleconference? We'll close public testimony. Okay. let's wishes of the committee?
Chairman.
Representative Harris.
Since, you know, we had one person, as you know, and I think you are as well, pretty strong supporter of labor, but I haven't had a lot of people in labor come to my office and talk about this bill, and we had the one person testify there, but it was pretty vague on why they opposed it. I didn't see a lot of, I'm at this point in time not opposed to moving the bill, so I think, Chairman, I'd like to move that we move Senate Bill 120, version A, out of committee with individual recommendations, and the attached fiscal note, if there is any, fiscal notes.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objections? Representative Croft.
And briefly, so we can continue our business, I don't think we should force these employees out of the Jones Act if they don't want to go. And they've testified through their union representative they don't want to go. From my knowledge of workers' compensation and Jones Act a little bit and the general scheme for recovering damages, you guys wouldn't want to be either under workers' comp. It severely limits your benefits. It severely limits what a jury can award for your damage on the job. The trade-off is they give you a lot less quicker. And I think that ought to be the employees that make that decision. What we'll be setting up here is a system where the state employees have gotten excluded from the Jones Act, where all other seamen working in private companies are in it. I don't think that's either rational or fair. And I would want in that job, which can sometimes be dangerous, the knowledge that if I were severely injured, I wouldn't have the artificial caps of the workers' compensation system. A quick, small remedy isn't much solace to me. So I was waiting to hear what the representative of those employees said. That was the most important factor to me. But there are also some really good reasons not to force people to do this. If they want to bargain for it, they can. Or maybe not, actually. But if they decide that they want to, that would be different. How about that?
Any other discussion on this motion? Does the administration care to talk to this?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly. I think it's illustrative that both MEBA, MMMP, and others have not spoken out against this. We've been in contact with the IBU. They had their representative in judiciary stated on the record that probably 98 to 99% of their members will be better off in a workers' compensation structure than in a Jones Act structure. The administration thinks this is good policy. It's good policy for firemen. It's good policy for police officers. It's good policy for our employees. We can't allow non-state seamen to be in our workers' comp because of the federal law. We can allow a better remedy for our state-employed seamen. The administration thinks that's the route we should go.
You have to stand at ease. We'll meet back to order. We were under discussion with moving the bill from committee. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Kevin to come forward again, and I want to follow up on what Representative Croft's question was. This piece of legislation, Kevin, basically then requires that seamen working on the Alaska Marine Highway System or whatever the state operated vessels that they qualify under the Jones Act would have to be under the workman's compensation insurance rather than a different type of a protection system under the Jones Act. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that would take away. Right now, they could be under either, depending upon what they bargained for.
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
I say right now, those people could be under either system, depending upon what they bargained for.
No, Mr. Chairman. At one time, they did bargain to be included under workers' comp. Single individual litigated the issue whether it was a bargainable issue. The Alaska Supreme Court said that you cannot bargain your way out of the Jones Act. Then the footnote, they said, the only way the state can allow this is if they pass a statute that's asserting their immunity to be sued from Jones Act, in which case then they could move them under workers' comp. And so they bargained for it. Supreme Court said, non-bargainable issue, but if you do want this, this is how you do it, and that's by statute. And so that's what this piece of legislation does. It provides a statutory ability to bring the state-employed seamen under our workers' comp laws.
But they are required to come under that, though. They don't have the option to be under the Jones Act requirements. Is that right?
That's correct. They do not now, and they would not afterwards. The difference would be they'd be switched from one to the other. So there is no provision for hybrid. If we assert our immunity, in which case we'd bring under workers' comp, and we'd like to think that we're providing a better remedy, at least for the vast majority of our state employees on the seamen.
So then the difference between the two systems, explain to me just briefly, the difference between the two systems is, as Representative Cross said, a quicker, less payment, is that correct? If they got hurt, what? Kind of go into that, because you raise an issue, and I'd like to make sure that I understand that completely.
For the more detailed questions as to how they operate.
Yes, come forward and state your name.
Through the chair, my name is Susan Cox. Representative Harris, there are no-fault remedies now for seamen, traditional maritime remedies. If you become injured or ill on a vessel, you're entitled to your wages until the end of the voyage without deduction from your sick leave account. So you get your regular paycheck for that voyage, whether it's a week on, 2 weeks on, or even a longer voyage. You also receive maintenance, which is known as a stipend to cover, theoretically it was initially intended to cover food and lodging, but it's a $45 a day payment under most of our agreements with the employees. $45 a day until you recover and are able to return to the vessel or have at least reach the maximum point of recovery that you're going to achieve. Those are no-fault remedies that are currently paid now. In addition, if you are injured on a vessel and you believe it's the fault of the employer, you have the right to sue the employer under the Jones Act. You must prove negligence on the employer's part. You have to hire a lawyer. You have to share what you get with the lawyer. But if you do sue, the potential range of damages you could recover would be more substantial, at least the types of damages you can get would be more substantial than would be available in your typical no-fault workers' compensation claim. On the one hand, however, if you have an injured employee who has a sprain or a strain or misses a period of work and has no intention of suing, $45 a day maintenance is probably less significant, a smaller payment, than what you would get under workers' comp, which is something more equivalent to 80% of your regular net wage tax-free. So when Mr. Jardel spoke of the system that we are proposing in this legislation, moving to workers' comp, being more beneficial to the majority of employees, it would provide, as a no-fault measure, workers' comp would provide more as an economic compensation to most employees with most injuries. In the case of a more significant injury where someone is inclined to bring a lawsuit or would potentially want to sue the employer if they had that opportunity, the potential for recovery is greater under the Jones Act. But again, they have to prove fault, they have to get past affirmative defenses, and they have to hire a lawyer to do it.
So then if I'm hearing what you said right, the Jones Act is better if you have to sue for damages above and beyond what you normally be compensated for. Workman's comp is better for you if you are just going to go through the regular process of trying to recover your lost wages or paid for lost time or whatever.
And to that, not always, because there's also times when even though you litigate and there's potentially a greater windfall at the end, and I think that's mostly through pain and suffering, which is not allowable under workers' comp. We've had some instances where it's taken 4 years before that compensation reaches the injured person, whereas in workers' comp, and they become destitute during those 4 years, waiting to pursue the litigation to its end to get that compensation for their injury. 4 years is a long time to be injured while on a state job, going through the court system, waiting so that you can get some wages. The workers' comp would provide immediate relief, no fault, so that you get, I believe, 80% of your net tax-free of your income. That's the policy call that, you know, this state has made for state employees. We think it's a good one. We think it's applicable here. Representative Croft made the issue that the danger, you know, we have other DOT employees that are working on heavy equipment. I mentioned firemen and police officers who are also daily engaged in very dangerous work. This is a policy that we think benefits state employees. And I think it shows that it was bargained for 8 years until the Supreme Court said, well, you can't bargain for that.
From Don, real quick. We have time for that.
We have any questions? Representative Stoltz?
Maybe Mr. Jardell could help me with what's the definition of a seaman? How many people are we talking about? Is this all Marine Highway employees, and does this cover people on enforcement vessels? I don't have any idea even how many people we're talking about.
Through the chair, I think I can answer that. Representative Stoltz, the definition of a seaman would apply to all the people who work on the ships of the Alaska Marine Highway System. I believe there's something in the area of 650 Marine Highway employees who work on ships. We also do have employees who work on law enforcement and research vessels, and they would be affected too. The definition of a seaman is one generally set out in, as a matter of federal law. But as long as they work in aid, it's supposed to be in furtherance of the navigation of the vessel, but they don't have to be steering the ship to be a seaman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this could affect at least three different state agencies, Fish and Game, Public Safety, and the Department of Transportation, maybe more, but I'm not.
That's correct, Representative Stoltz.
Do you have any questions or comments, Representative Croft? We do have Mr. Lipinski online that would like to respond. Peter? Are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In regards to Mrs. Cox's comments, right now we have in our contract that the employee, if they get off sick or injured, will get 84 hours or paid to the end of the voyage. That will still be in the contract. That will not be taken away. And also, we've had members on the Marine Highway System. It is a very seasonal job for a lot of people. They do not make a lot of money their first 3 or 4 years out of there, and a lot of them at 70% would be getting very minimal payments. The $45 a day, if they get sick, helps them out quite a bit. Plus, they get maintenance on their medical bills are paid until they reach maximum medical cure. And if I'm not mistaken, if they went under workman's comp and they just got sick on the job, they would get nothing because it was not an on-the-job injury. So that would be very detrimental to our members, as they are, a lot of them are seasonal, and they don't have medical coverage. And this would be, like I said, a big detriment to them. And that's all the comments I have on that subject.
Thank you, Peter. Representative Croft.
I know we're pressed for time. I'll just sum up if you'd like.
Pardon?
I know we're pressed for time. I'll sum up if you'd like, if you're ready to have a vote on that. You know, it's all very well, Mr. Chairman, for Mr. Jardell or Ms. Cox to tell us what they think is in the best interest of their employees. But we're hearing from the employees now, and they disagree. They would like to stay under the Jones Act. From what I know, there are good reasons why they would want to stay under the Jones Act. If I were in a dangerous occupation on a boat, I would want to stay under the Jones Act. And I don't think we should deprive them of that right.
Mr. Chairman, just in response to that, I think that there is a split. I think there is a disagreement amongst the members of the different labor union that some want it and some don't. It's not a cut and dried. This one wants it. And they all want it. There's a split. So I think right now you have the law that says you have to do it one way. Some people, as in previous years, had voted to do it another way. They were taken out by federal law, forced to go one way. This gives them an option to go, or not an option, but it requires them to go a different way. So it's which way do you want to require them to go? So, and since there isn't seemingly to be any kind of unanimous support amongst even the members, I'm going to support this bill.
All for the question.
Representative Whitaker?
Yes.
Representative Chenault?
Yes.
Representative Croft?
No.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Hawker? Representative Meyer?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
No.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Harris?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
78-0.
Bill moves from committee with an individual recommendation. Chapter 7. Next, we'll go to House Bill 115. Senate Bill 115. Yes. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 115 is a very simple bill which allows the Department of Corrections to pay state employee salaries and benefits from the Correctional Industries Fund. Currently, the department operates 8 Correctional Industries programs throughout the state and has 14 employees in the program. The Correctional Industries include the Juneau Commercial Laundry, the Fairbanks Garment Flat Goods Shop, Kenai Office Furniture Systems Plant, the Eagle River Garment Shop, Kenai Metals Plant, Seward Wood Furniture Plant, the Palmer Auto Body Shop, and the Juneau Staff Guard Hospital Laundry. We also provide inmate labor and security at the Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant under Correctional Industries. The purpose of Senate Bill 115 is to allow the Correctional Industries programs to be fully self-supporting by allowing all the expenses of the Correctional Industries to be paid from the revenues derived from Correctional Industries product sales. Now, it's my understanding that Representative Meyer will have a CS for Senate Bill 115, which is patterned after comes from discussions that were held in House State Affairs on House Bill 161, which was a companion bill. And the purpose of that CS, which the department supports, is to make it very clear that the Correctional Industries will cooperate with and work for the benefit of private industry, and that will the intent of that is to ensure that revenues can be increased enough to make it self-supporting. We're talking about $960,000 in state employee salaries that would be paid from the fund.
Representative Stolson and Harris.
Yeah, thank you. Probably a matter of interest to Representative Harris as well. Just maybe you can describe what are the plans for Mount McKinley meat processing plant, because it does have impact in both of our districts.
At this point, and I actually just discussed this with Nico Buss from the Department of Natural Resources yesterday, Department of Natural Resources through the Division of Agriculture is going to be supporting the product manager's salaries within the Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant, and Department of Corrections will continue to provide security and inmate labor there and do the accounting for product sales.
Representative Harris.
You're not planning to shut it down, though.
The Department of Corrections has no plans to make any changes in their operation at this point.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. $963,000, you're shifting it from to an item, Correction Industries Fund, which all sounds wonderful, shifting it off of general funds, but in reality, it's still all general funds. But here's the deal. Are you making $963,000 in the Correctional Industries system?
This year, at the end of FY03, if our projections are correct, to the Chair, Representative Harris, we expect to have approximately roughly $400,000 in balance in the Correctional Industries product cost funds. The department is working in a number of ways to increase sales, and the CS, which Representative Meyer, I believe, is going to bring forth this afternoon, gives us some more tools to increase those revenues. The other thing that the department has done recently, we closed our Juneau office of Alaska Correctional Industries, which had 2 people and a $50,000 a year grant, and we will now, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is moving into that office. We'll be avoiding those costs. We have some other costs we're avoiding. We've got an online catalog, so we believe that we're going to be able to make most of this work this year.
Jerry, you didn't tell me what I wanted to know. You said you had $400,000. I'm asking you, do you make $960,000? Is that what you're saying you do here? And this, the way I read this,
we intend to make that much or nearly that much in the future.
How do you do that?
We'll be increasing product sales.
You're going to compete with the private sector or what?
No, we will not be competing with the private sector. The current statute requires that the Correctional Industries Fund has findings whenever we expand correctional industries that we are not competing or not detrimental to the private sector. The CS, which I believe Representative Myers will have this afternoon, actually makes that a more positive statement that we'll work with and in support of the private sector, or words to that effect. So we believe that we can generate significant additional revenue.
I don't have any problem with you supporting yourself. I think that's fine. I just make sure that you don't go out there and have prisoners unduly competing with somebody who's paying taxes and all that kind of thing. You know, but I think that's fine. That I get a little very suspicious of shifting these monies around.
Right.
I mean, I understand the process is strictly a matter of what category you put it in. It all comes out of the, in the end, it all comes out of the same pot.
Representative Stoltz. Mr. Chairman, I just had a real quick question. We're going to use the term avoiding costs. Was that an artful term? Does that mean it's deferred, or is it actual savings, or maybe it was just an...
Through the Chair, Representative Stoltz, what I was referring to as the example of reducing our lease costs, that money which we're avoiding a cost that we currently have a cost of $50,000 a year for that lease. In FY04, we won't have that $50,000 cost. We'll still have... It won't affect our revenue, so...
Words mean thing around here, and I always like to make sure I hear what I think I hear.
Okay, what I'm going to do with this is wait until we get the CS before we go any further with this bill. This afternoon.
No, CS.
Thank you. Hopefully we'll have it this afternoon. If not, hopefully we get it.
Okay.
House Bill 61. Sponsored by Representative Chenault, and I think you have three amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Are you ready to introduce them at this time?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Amendment number one.
I move amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion purposes.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if they're online or not, but some of the representatives that we've worked with on this amendment here. There was some concern from Representative Hawker shown at the last meeting on this, determining when the credit starts to apply and when it ends. What this language here attempts is to pretty much set the parameters of what that when that tax credit can, what can be used in the tax credit, when it starts and when it finishes.
Okay. Any questions? I'll remove my objections. Representative Whitaker?
I need just a minute to understand the language, if I can, Mr. Chairman.
We're working from Q, Mr. Chairman? Yeah.
Q, yes.
Q.
Right. Yeah, I think online, Mr. Chairman, we do have John Barnes with Marathon, Kathy Zabel, who is, I believe, their...
Online?
Online.
I'm not sure if Kathy's there, but the other
one. Okay.
And we also have Doug, director, if there's any other questions that we can't answer. Our CPA is gone today, so.
You should be all right.
Thank you.
Craft, you have any question?
I don't think I have any objection to it. I think I understand it, and I think it's appropriate.
Okay. No objections? Mm-hmm. Amendment moved. Amendment number two. No.
I'll move amendment number two, Mr. Chairman.
Discuss the amendment, please.
Thank you. What the amendment did, there were some concerns and some questions on who could actually take the, I believe this is what this amendment attempts to do. It would change persons to operators and working interest owners directly. And there was some question dealing with who could actually take the tax credit. And by having persons in there versus the proposed new language, what they felt is if a subcontractor or a contractor used a backhoe on a project, maybe he could try to use this tax credit, and that's not the intent or the incentive there. So by removing persons and putting in operators and working owners directly, then that ties it just into the exploration corporations. Tries to remove a little loophole.
Any questions for the sponsor? If not, is there any objections?
No, I move my objection.
No objections, and amendment moves. And number three.
I'll move amendment three.
Check for conversation.
Amendment three is put in. This language was originally not in the bill. We were asked to put in by one of the departments, and after further investigation of it, the department determined that they actually did not want it in there. What it would deal with is this ties it into just the income tax versus including all taxes could go into many different other areas other than just an income tax credit. So to tighten it up and bring it back where this bill only affects, will only be an income tax credit and not any other credit that they could receive from any other programs they may be involved with.
Mm-hmm. Mikey's batting 1,000.
No. Any objections? Moves?
That's all my amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. That's our Senate committee. Representative Foster.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out HB 6-1 out of committee as amended with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? If not, bill moves from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Individual recommendations and catch.
I guess we can adjourn
at this time. And does anything come before this committee before we adjourn? Nothing to come before the committee before we adjourn. We do have this afternoon at 1:30, House Bill 162, increased business license fees. House Bill 192, DNR lead resource development projects. House Bill 211, nurse education loan repayment program. House Bill 299, parole for medical. House Bill 271, rental car tax. So nothing more to come before this meeting.
I know you want to turn, but just for scheduling purposes, a lot of times I've been scheduling people to meet with at 3:30, 4 o'clock. Do you plan between now and end of session going till 5 or 6 or
at
whatever?
At least until we're done with the agenda, and if anything, we may have to recess till tomorrow morning or whatever.
Okay, so pretty much leave our afternoons free for this committee. Okay.
Do we have, Mr. Chairman, do we have, is 271 up here in this committee?
Do we have 271?
We expect to get it after the floor goes in, and it has passed out of ways. And
okay, so it'll be right across the room.
Yeah, so we'll get it just before we, and the backup is available.
Before we adjourn also, Senator Murkowski will be meeting with us at 10 o'clock. I want to thank the committee members for
getting it
prompt so we can meet with her here. Nothing more to come before the committee. This committee's adjourned.
Ouch.